Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Yes, the schedule is a bit all over the place this week because we're playing early on a Saturday and we played last night against Liverpool. I thought the best thing to do was do a post-game podcast this morning, which will take the place of the regular Friday Arsecast. But on Friday, we will do the Premier League preview podcast on Patreon. So you can join us for that at patreon.com/arseblog. It is a bank holiday here in Ireland. Of course, March 17th is St. Patrick's Day. So may all your beer today be green, and may all your shamrocks be shamrocky or some shit like that. Anyway, March 17th is also a particularly special day in this household because it's someone's birthday. Whose birthday? Archer, the German Shepherd. He is 10 today. So a big happy birthday to Archer, who's going to get some kind of meat-based cake later on, because what else do you give a dog on his very special 10th birthday? So there you go. Anyway, we will get on with the show. Less waffle, more talking about Arsenal, more talking about the 2-0 defeat to Liverpool last night, which I think is an interesting game to chat about. There are some good things. Obviously, losing is never good, but I think there are things we can discuss, and with me to do that is Andrew Allen. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm all right. A bit kind of groggy. It was a late night last night with these 8:15 kickoffs and then straight up early in the morning to record.
You know? We were just talking about that, like 8:15. Yeah. It's only half an hour, but it does make a difference. I don't know what it is, but it's not quite right. It doesn't feel right to kick off a game at 8:15. 8 o'clock, you're pushing it. 8:15, taking the piss.
Yeah, I don't think the Arsenal press conference quotes dropped on the main website until just before midnight.
Right.
And if you're waiting for those, that definitely psychologically makes a difference when you're thinking about going to bed.
So, a defeat to Liverpool, I guess, is not entirely unexpected, but it's one of those games where we try and measure where we are, what we're doing, how we're going, what progress we're making, because there have been some difficult games against Liverpool in the past. Even when we've thought we're making a bit of progress, we've been sort of slapped back into reality by a couple of performances against them. They tend to score a lot of goals against us. So while I don't want to say, losing 2-0 is actually quite a decent measure of where we are, I think we have to try and look at it within that kind of context, not least because it's something that Mikel Arteta himself was keen to stress afterwards, whether that's just keeping his players focused on what's to come or whatever. But I think he genuinely saw, as he said, between the boxes, two sides that were actually competing with each other. And that very much tallies with what I saw in particular in the first half, which I thought was very competitive, if not spectacular from either side.
Yeah, I thought we were very, certainly in that first half, I think we had a game plan. We had some ideas that we were trying to execute. I thought our shape was very good by and large. You know, the gaps between ourselves and the Liverpool players were as they should be. You know, we felt relatively comfortable, I thought, at times. I think what became apparent, and it's been the recurring theme, is that Arsenal up against Van Dijk and Matip and Fabinho, we just really struggle. We struggle to score goals, I guess. And I don't know whether it's not just a psychological thing when you see those names on the team sheet. I mean, I felt quite confident pre-game. I mean, there was a level of confidence that I haven't felt going into an Arsenal-Liverpool game in a while last night. But I was just taking my seat as they were reading out the team names and the Liverpool kind of, you know, they were just rolling through the Liverpool names and suddenly your heart sinks and goes, oh, actually, this isn't just a case of, oh, we're really good. It should be okay. We'll give them a good go. You just think, oh, God, they've got some incredible players. And I thought what was really interesting last night is that, you can see now that Arteta has got his players learning their lines. They know what to do wherever they are on the pitch. The next level is basically doing what Liverpool do. They don't just know their own lines. They know the lines of everyone in the production, right? Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah. They can just fill in at every place and they know exactly what they're doing. They're so in tune. It's great that we've learnt our lines, but yeah, we've got another year or two to go, I think.
Yeah, maybe we need to learn how to improvise a bit as well, which I think, yeah, you know, is something that Liverpool are very good at. And look, you know, they started with Luis Diaz and Diogo Jota, and like 5 minutes into the second half, he's got Firmino and Salah lined up on the sideline. And
yeah,
as much as we like to talk about their maturity as a team, their experience and everything else, they have a depth of quality, which I think is something that we're still some distance from. And we can talk about various aspects of that. But there really is something to just having that collection of talented players who, you know, are talented in their own right, but as part of what Jurgen Klopp is doing at Liverpool and has done at Liverpool, like you say, if they're not quite interchangeable, they're certainly very much all on the one wavelength. So when you take two players off, put two players, or you take the first goal scorer off after he's just put them ahead, and you're improving your team by putting on Salah and Firmino, I mean, that is still something that we have to try and build, but also contend with in fixtures like this.
Yeah, and look, I mean, It's gonna take some time. I mean, I think that the difficulty Arteta's had, I guess, is he's had to spend so many of his transfer windows getting rid of players to then get himself into a position where he can then afford to bring new ones in, that it's never really been a case about him being able to go out and just sort of cherry pick the guys that he wants to come in and go from there. It's taking, I think, maybe longer than Liverpool. I think there was more of a repair job to do about Arsenal when Arteta came in, whereas Klopp, I guess, was sort of taking over from Rodgers, who'd already started to lay some reasonable foundations there for a team that was going in the right direction. There were plenty of positives last night. I genuinely felt that the 11 that we put out there was competitive from the off, and in every position I thought they gave a very decent kind of account of themselves. Maybe a couple of them will have realised that they're going to have to go to another level. I think we all know that Ødegaard, for example, has been brilliant in recent weeks. And I think last night they obviously made a point of trying to, you know, snaffle his creativity in the center of the park. He did everything he could. But, you know, again, the key thing, I guess, Arteta pointed out was the fact that there was a difference in the box. And last night with Lacazette, it just feels like you're sort of playing with, you know, an extra midfielder rather than an actual focal point of the attack. And there was that moment when Thiago made the back pass. I don't want to kind of rush too far ahead, but it was almost identical to, do you remember when Steven Gerrard did that against us in 2006?
Yes.
It was a back pass that went to Henry. Henry just took that, ran the keeper, put it in the back of the net, game won. Difference. That's the difference in the box. On this occasion, Lacazette, I mean, he didn't do too badly. I mean, he kind of laboured towards the ball, got control of it, gave it back to Ødegaard, but the chance went.
Well, I mean, while we're on this, I think we might as well talk about it. And I don't want to flog a dead horse or anything like that, because the Lacazette discussion has been done to death. And, you know, we're between ourselves, every time there's a press conference, it's like, oh, you're asking the Lacazette contract question again, are you? Really? Even though he's answered it like every week for the last fucking 6 months, it feels like. And the answer has always been the same, that they're going to look at it at the end of the season. And maybe the landscape has changed a little bit in the absence of Aubameyang and his departure. Maybe it has. But I think I want to look at it not so much as a discussion of what Lacazette can and can't do, because I think we've done that. We all know that. And he's trying very hard, but you could see very clearly where there is a difference in the boxes. Again, the sharpness, the ability, the movement, the way that he might pull defenders around if he was a different kind of center forward. Or let's put it another way. If you want to be really positive about, you know, where this team can go, last night was an illustration of what a new centre forward could bring to this team from an attacking perspective, because it's not just about the goal scorer or the striker scoring goals. It's about what he can do to facilitate some of the others. And I know that's been a strength of Lacazette's play at times, but yesterday, I just think some of the movement, he's a bit slow, a bit ponderous. And I think your point about playing with an extra midfielder rather than a striker is a really good one. So this isn't a moratorium on Lacazette, because worn the t-shirt, but I'm looking at it and thinking, okay, when we've got Martinelli and we've got Saka and we've got Odegaard, we've got Smith Rowe, I'm now looking to see what happens next. And that, if we're looking for positives, I think is one we can start to hang our hats on a little bit when it comes to the summer, albeit, you know, it's a bit down the line and we do have games to play and we do need Lacazette and the others to contribute between now and then.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting was actually you look at the goal that Firmino scores and the run that he makes across the near post. And you think, well, if Arsenal had had a bloke making that run, the two times that Martinelli kind of got to the byline, then suddenly you've got a guy who's there to finish off an excellent bit of play. And what we don't have at the moment is, I guess, that kind of figure. It was something that, I mean, I don't want to really compare Olivier Giroud and Alex Lacazette, but Olivier Giroud was an out-and-out striker who got across his man at the near post and scored a lot of goals there. Yeah. You know, he finished off moves. We're now getting to the point where, as a team, we're flowing, we're creating opportunities. We just don't have the guy there to put the ball in the back of the net. Now, would we create some of those opportunities if Lacazette wasn't dropping back in the first place? I don't know. I mean, it's going to have to be an incredible upgrade to have someone who's able to combine both the ability to drop deep and the ability to go in the box and score. I mean, maybe he doesn't need to do two. We just amend the team around him. But yeah, it is at the moment, I think, the difference. And it's not lost on anyone inside the club, outside the club, anybody watching Arsenal. And as you say, it's not to denigrate Lacazette. I think what he's doing is incredible, very hardworking, but he's just not that guy at the moment. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly on our to-do list, and it doesn't actually make any difference whether Lacazette stays or not. You know, if Nketiah goes and we've already lost Lacazette, we need to buy strikers, and those strikers are going to have to be finishers this summer, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot to do in that area of the pitch for sure, particularly if Nketiah goes, which looks likely, and Lacazette, you know, I see the calls for giving him a one-year contract or whatever, but I'm not sure what the player wants. I think when a player gets to his age, he's probably going to want a longer deal, more security, and, you know, maybe he want to play a lot. If Arsenal go out and sign a big, shiny new striker who's going to be our number nine in all the games that we're going to play, if you're Lacazette, do you sign on for 10-minute substitute appearances and some cup games and what have you when you're at this point in your career? I'm not sure that's the case. So even if Arsenal were to try and do it, he might not be into it himself. So it is something that we're going to have to reckon with. I think we should talk about that chance then, the Thiago back pass, which I guess he just didn't see Lacazette, who was probably behind Van Dijk or Matip or one of those. How do you view what happened next? Lacazette took it. I think this is really, really good goalkeeping, to be honest. Yeah. I think it's easy for a goalkeeper to panic in that split second when the ball comes through and Lacazette goes. I mean, how many times have you seen a goalkeeper make a split second decision where he clatters the attacker, he concedes a penalty, goes to ground, gets rounded? I think what Alisson does on both occasions is absolutely top-class goalkeeping, in that he stays on his feet, he forces Lacazette to make the pass, and the focus he has on Odegaard as he closes him down is really quite something. When there's a great replay, you know, where it's behind Odegaard, and you can see Alisson just watching, and he makes a very good save. You could say it's a miss, but I think it's more great goalkeeping than a bad miss. If Odegaard had put it wide, for example, bad miss. But I think it's very, very good goalkeeping.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually my instant reaction in the stadium. And I think probably a reaction that was shared by most, because you know when a player's done a bad miss, because the stadium reacts with a sort of angry growl, groan. You know, people hit the seats in front of them. There's a different noise, whereas that was very much the sort of, oh, and then everybody kind of taking a moment going, oh, that was a good save, wasn't it? And yeah, everyone going, yeah. That was, and it was. I mean, as you say, I mean, he stayed on his feet when Lacazette got the ball, which gave him the opportunity to then make the second save. And I think if you were going to criticise Ødegaard, you'd say a natural goal scorer there might take it first time when the, you know, when there's a bit more space to find the back of the net.
But sure.
I think if you're Martin Ødegaard and you've got a 6 foot something Alisson doing a starfish right in front of you from 3 yards, you know, he did everything he could to sort of smash it in the goal. As you say, it was on target. And Alisson ultimately, you know, he did what he needed to do, but he didn't know where the ball was going to go. And he's got lucky that it's gone over the bar. So, you know, fair play to him. It did feel like a big moment. It always kind of does, because when you're a side, it doesn't necessarily, I mean, especially against a Liverpool team that don't concede that many chances.
Yeah.
There was a moment where I think people's hearts sort of sunk a little bit. And obviously, minutes later, there we go.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you flip it around and Aaron Ramsdale does that to Mo Salah, we would be talking about Aaron Ramsdale making an absolutely brilliant save rather than it being a dreadful miss from Salah. But I guess we have to talk about Aaron Ramsdale in relation to the first Liverpool goal. I've watched it back quite a few times, and look, I think he will be more disappointed than anybody. The old adage about how goalkeepers should never be beaten at their near post, I'm not sure it's always true, but I think this is one of those instances where it absolutely is true, because he did get a hand on it, wasn't strong enough. I also think we do have to talk about how that chance came about as well. Ben White got pulled into the middle, and Cedric, it's always been my fear with him that players can just run away from him a bit too easily. And this was one of those moments where half a second, he just switched off. Jota ran through. I'm tired of Diogo Jota, I have to say.
Yeah,
I'm very, very, very tired of seeing him. But it's a goal that when you look back on it, we should have done a lot better with.
Yeah, Thiago kind of picks the ball up very deep, doesn't he? Mm. I have to say the pass is incredible, because he threads it right between Saka and Partey. And I think in so doing, Cedric is completely caught out by the run. He's caught, you know, just sort of a momentary lapse in concentration, and Jota's in there. You know, it was frustrating that it was one ball straight through.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of corridor between Ben White and Cedric. But you know, Jota's just a player full of confidence, and even in that situation, you know, a lot of players fluff their lines, and he just kind of drove in, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do. I mean, I guess Ramsdale, thinking about it, was probably expecting him to go across, you know, to the other side.
Yeah, maybe. Or a cutback.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it wasn't quite Steve Highway versus Bob Wilson in the 1971 FA Cup final getting caught in the near post there, but it wasn't pretty from Ramsdale. And as you say, like, I mean, I don't need to tell Aaron Ramsdale that he's probably disappointed with himself there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, on Cedric, I think by and large over the course of the last few weeks, we've all looked at him and thought he's done a pretty solid job off the back of being part of a consistent back four, kind of knowing his job. And I think, you know, what you saw last night was the difference between a Harvey Barnes and a Diogo Jota. Like, at the weekend, you can kind of get away with it against Leicester. And last night you didn't. And you know, again, he wouldn't be playing if Tomiyasu was fit. And that is a key area, I guess, for us to upgrade in the future.
I mean, or keeping Tomiyasu fit. And this is this maybe explains why there is such a measure of caution about him and about bringing him back and making sure that he's 100% fit. Because when you look at the remaining fixtures that we have, we don't have too many Watfords and Brentfords left. We've got Tottenham, we've got Chelsea, we've got Man United. We've got big games against teams that are West Ham as well. Do we have to play West Ham as well?
So, yeah, away. Yeah.
You know, so there are some big games where I think his presence in those games just gives us that extra little bit of solidity. And again, it's not like go to town on Cedric time, even though I think there's an issue in the second goal as well. But it highlights the importance of those first choice players. I mean, you could say the same if it were, I don't know, Rob Holding in for Ben White maybe, or Gabriel, and whatever it might be. Like, there is always some kind of drop off when it comes to your backups, particularly when you have a small squad.
I mean, my concern about Tomiyasu is obviously this injury will have stretched from pretty much December through till April by the time he plays.
Yeah.
And dropping him into into the team when every game is massive is going to be quite difficult. Like, he needs to get some minutes somewhere to get up to speed, because he strikes me as a quite I don't know whether introverted character is the right thing, but he thinks a lot about his own game, and you know, he wrote in his column that he has in one of the Japanese newspapers about, you know, building up his confidence and whether or not he was good enough to be at Arsenal and understanding all the tactics and all the rest of it. And you kind of think, if a player like that goes into a game not feeling completely sort of sound in their own body, that level of doubt can, you know, cause issues as soon as someone starts running at you. And I think we saw that in the Carabao Cup semi-final when he was thrown in and he wasn't fit, and Jota completely wrecked him that night. So to be fair, it doesn't, you know, in two games running at the Emirates, Jota's taken advantage of both of our right backs.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it is important that we get him back, because I think he does bring something different. He's just physically more of a monster than Cedric. I think people look at Cedric and think, I can beat this guy. And obviously Jota's not a big guy either. So, you know, there wasn't much of a physical battle for him to worry about there.
Yeah. I just think Tomiyasu has a defensive mindset, a kind of switched onness, if you like, in the final third, in the defensive third, that Cedric doesn't quite have.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with the second goal, I don't think you see Tomiyasu doing what Cedric did, which was sort of desperately trying to make a race up the pitch to help Saka and give him an option to start a breakaway, which ultimately, you know, killed us positionally there.
Yeah, I mean, that was a poor decision from him, I think. Given that entire passage of play, you know, there were moments where we could have cleared it. I think Gabriel was soft to lose it on the edge of the box the way that he did, and it scrambled around. We got it half clear. And I think when you're in a situation like that, having just conceded, when you're under that kind of pressure and the ball breaks the way that it does, I just question the... Look, in some ways, maybe this is the instruction. When there's a chance to break, when Liverpool have pushed forward, let's try and break. But I'm just wondering who exactly he was going to break with in that moment. I'm just going to watch it again. I mean, most of the Arsenal players are in the Arsenal penalty area.
I can tell you, because I counted them this morning, that we had 10 men within 8 yards of the goal line when they scored.
Right. And, so and where was Cedric? What was he going to do? Like,
yeah, I mean, it was going to be a very difficult kind of breakaway goal we were going to score there, especially as it was sort of Saka on his own going up the wing. It wasn't great. But again, you know, ruthless from Liverpool. Absolutely ruthless.
Yeah.
You know, Robertson did exactly what he needed to do, took advantage of the space, drove to the byline, had a man to pick out, found him, goal.
And yeah.
Emirates at that point just went...
Yeah, like you could feel the air come out of the place a bit. I mean, you will know yourself, you were there. But like a one goal deficit against Liverpool is tough enough. When you concede two, and I think this is quite often a measure of really good teams, is that when they land a punch, before you've had time to right yourself, they smack you about the back of the head with another one, you know, as we used to do in our pump. You'd score a goal, and before they even had a chance to regroup or get themselves settled again, you score another one, and that's basically game over, you know. I do think that the defending in general for that goal was not great, though. Gabriel, I mean, Firmino's movement, it's excellent, and he's a top-quality player. There's no two ways about it, but I do think that's the sort of thing where you could defend better as a central defender. Like, he's got him, he doesn't have him, he's trying to step up, he's caught in two minds. I just think if he stays tight with the man, he prevents that chance, you know? And I guess that's the way Mikel Arteta will be looking at these goals, and the way that he will be talking to his players about these goals when they analyze the game, when they analyze the way we conceded. Part of the process is, well, look at what we did here, bit by bit, break it down into its separate chunks and say, look, in those moments, this is what you're going to have to do next time?
I mean, he definitely referenced the goals as being poor goals to concede last night when he was sort of reflecting on the game. And I think he was, you know, he has that kind of seething anger post-game when Arsenal lose. Like, he just can't. there's no kind of fake smiles when Arsenal lose, when Arteta's facing it. And I think there was that sort of real, there was a very fine line between the pride he felt for the overall performance and the frustration he felt at being quite close but not quite close enough.
Yeah.
And it sort of being, you know, not a too dissimilar mistake for us to make. You know, it takes one moment, switch off, and then suddenly goal, game over. Because it was like that against City, really. You know, tiny moments made the difference in the end. But look, I mean, I still think there's a lot of positives to take. I mean, I think frustratingly, obviously, we played Liverpool four times this season.
It's too
much. Not scored. it's too much. But too we've not scored. We've conceded eight. You know, that's quite a lot. There is still a gap there. I don't know that Liverpool are going to get much worse in the next couple of seasons. I mean, if they manage to hold on to Salah, for example, I know that some of their players are aging and whatnot, but there's a few Rolls Royce in there, and they have a very good scouting department. Luis Diaz looks like a real, real player.
Yeah.
So it's just going to be very, very hard to close that gap because they are not giving up on, you know, pushing themselves higher and higher.
I mean, the motivation that they had going into this game, was huge. Knowing that a win would put the title in their hands, more or less, because if they can beat Man City when they play in a couple of weeks, you know, it really feels like the title is going to come down to that game between those two teams, because City have won what? I don't know how many City have won in a row, or they drew against Palace, obviously, the other night, but Liverpool have won nine in a row. You know, they were talking about our five in a row wins, which is good, but Liverpool had won eight in a row. And both of these teams are capable of going on those kind of runs, not simply not losing, but just winning game after game after game, the relentlessness of those wins. And that's something I think we have to take into account when we think about the result, the performance. I know opinions will vary based on, what people think of how well we did overall or didn't do. I think Arteta was probably talking up just a little bit the quality of our performance between the two boxes. I think there were things that certainly we could have improved, but knowing we've got Villa on Saturday and he's trying to talk up these players into believing, and I think they were, competitive against Man City, competitive against Liverpool, who are the two best teams in the country. And from there, he's sending them this message that if you can do this against these teams, the other teams where those fine margins aren't quite as fine, where you don't have to be absolutely elite to score the goals or take advantage, then it sort of informs how you approach those games and the confidence levels you have.
Yeah, I think, and I know it's a big if at the moment, but if we make the Champions League, we won't be going up against sides much better than Manchester City and Chelsea and Liverpool. Mm. You know, these are, we basically got three of the world's best teams sitting above us in the league, and we're trying to close the gap on them. And I guess at the moment, without another competition in which we can compare ourselves, It could be tempting to get a bit downhearted about the fact that we can't get over the line against them. But, you know, I think it was interesting. I think on Tuesday night, was it Benfica made the quarterfinals of the Champions League? And that was a Benfica side that a year ago we beat without too much trouble in the Europa League. And I think back to what type of football we're playing now compared to them.
Yeah.
I think you put us into the Europa League this season right now, and we don't make those same mistakes. We go on and win that tournament. I think this Arsenal team right now, playing the football it's playing, could actually get to a quarterfinal of a Champions League, probably. I mean, obviously, depending on the draw stage and what have you.
And
I don't want to look too
front.
Far ahead, but I think that's probably Arteta's got to go, look, guys, best team in the world, second best team in the world. You're giving them a good go.
Yeah.
We are in the right, you know, we're going in the right direction.
I agree. I agree. I know it's really hard as well sometimes to think about, you know, defeats like the one against Man City, like the one against Liverpool, and say there are positives, or we should take all the positives from them and not focus on the fact that we haven't taken any points from either of those games, which I think, of course, is an issue. But I don't know what we learn from games like this unless we do see what the direction of travel is, what the positives are, what can we do to augment the things that are already good about this team, which I think are there. There are things. Gabriel Martinelli, for example, last night, there was somebody sent a tweet at me saying, well, was it that good? If you look at the stats, he had no shots on target, no key passes, whatever it was. And it's like, well, hang on. Use your eyes.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Your eyes tell you how well a guy played. And I thought he was absolutely sensational. And this is another aspect of when I think about the future. Those moments where he skinned Trent, the one where he nutmegged Henderson, got into the box, it was shimmy. Like, I think at the end of that, as brilliant as that was, I think there is a better pass to be made at the end of that as well. I'm not criticizing Martinelli. I'm just saying that this is still a 20-year-old player who is now really, for the first time, a first-team regular at Arsenal. And we can see his development. We can see his progress. And there are things that are going to come with time, with experience, with maturity, with more game time that will make him better again, you know? So I think when we think about this game against Liverpool, as disappointing as it is to lose any game, someone like Martinelli to do what he did, I mean, Klopp was quite funny afterwards talking about, well, if you say Trent can't defend, I'll knock you down. I think that's what he said on Sky Sports. Who are these people that say Trent can't defend? Oh, you know, you don't know anything about football. Well, okay, fair enough. But I watched Martinelli roast that guy a couple of times, and he's a brilliant footballer, Trent. There's no two ways about it. There was one pass. Was it early in the second half? First time pass, not long after their disallowed goal. It was like, holy shit, this guy is like amazing. Yeah. And defending isn't his strong point. At the same time, though, what Martinelli did yesterday, to me, that is part of why we can maintain a level of confidence about where we're going.
Yeah, I mean, I think Alexander-Arnold would have relished the battle that in the pressure that he was put under there, because it was an incredible test between the two of them. I thought what was really interesting with Martinelli is that he's always had that ability to skip past a player, and his decision making, has not always been great. But more than anything last night was his ball retention and his strength, I thought, really struck me, because he was given the ball a lot, but quite often had to go back towards his own goal with players around him, but he kept the ball. Whereas a couple of years ago, he would maybe make a loose pass, and those loose pass would lead to transition moments. Those transition moments would put us under pressure. And I think he's realizing sometimes you don't always have to go and do the big thing. You just need to keep the ball and keep the move working and moving. Mm. And I mean, he was great last night. I mean, you said earlier about, you know, you just have to use your eyes. When you're in the stadium, you just have to use your ears, because everybody is excited when he gets the ball. You know, there's this real sense of like electricity, and I love watching him run at people. But a bit, as I was saying earlier, is I think we need to give him someone else in the box to aim the ball at. I think he looked up a couple of times yesterday and saw just a blur of yellow shirts and sort of played a percentage pass when maybe, you know, he could have made a better pass. But also, if we'd had more people there to pass to, he might have had more chance of finding someone. So, I think it's interesting. I don't know about you, but I get the feeling that Martinelli almost prefers the big games. He always seems to come to the fore when, you know, there's a real big opponent and a big stage. Because he was excellent against City, even though he didn't score. And he was excellent last night, even though he didn't score. And he did almost everything but in both games.
Yeah.
And some of the quieter games, he's not quite been able to get himself into it. I don't know whether it's partly to do with our tactics and him being more of an outball and whatnot. But
I mean, maybe. It's hard to know, isn't it? Because there could be a psychological aspect to that when you're facing Liverpool. And also it's come off the back of a call up to the Brazil side, so I guess in a big game like that he's going to be super fired up, but I think he will be anyway. I think it's as much to do with the fact he's 20 and there are going to be issues of consistency, inconsistency, whatever you want to call it. You know, I thought Bukayo Saka was brilliant against Leicester, quieter last night. Martin Odegaard as well. I think there are reasons as to why he was quieter against Liverpool than he was against Leicester. But there is going to be some measure of inconsistency with young players. And that's why when I think about where we're going, when they can add that to their game, you know, Jota, Salah, Mane, I mean, they have their off days, but more often than not, they're on, and they will cause you significant problems, even if they don't score. And that's where I think we've got to go with this group of young players, in particular those, you know, higher up the pitch. It is going to be still part of the process that their levels are going to fluctuate a bit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What did you make of the substitutions in the end last night? It felt to me a bit like, you know, going into the last 15, 20 minutes, Arteta recognised this was not a game we were going to win. Just rest some legs before Villa, right?
Yeah.
He didn't kind of, you know, he could have easily, excuse me, thrown the kitchen sink at them, you know, kept Odegaard on, put Pepe and Smith Rowe on. And he kind of just went, ah, this isn't happening.
I did wonder about that, you know, because when we conceded the two quick goals, I was thinking, well, what can we do here to try and get something from this game? Because, you know, it was an hour in, just after the hour mark. So there's time to do something. But I just wonder if perhaps some of the scars of Liverpool games in the past were part of the instructions and the way that we dealt with the rest of the game. Like, I was thinking he can get Smith Rowe on, but who's he going to put him on for? Like, could you put him on for Xhaka, for example, and really have a go at Liverpool? But then if you ship another couple of goals and you end up being beaten 4-0, it's really difficult then to try and take anything positive from that game, which, you know, I think that played a part in what he was doing. I mean, Smith Rowe came on with 66 minutes, but he came on for Odegaard, and I think that was A, to maybe give Odegaard a rest, but B, to get some decent minutes into Smith Rowe's legs because he hasn't played a great deal in the last few weeks. Beyond that, I think you're right. It was about saving people. It was about getting Saka off the pitch before someone kicked him. I don't think they were really changes to try, as hard as this is to sort of contemplate, I don't think they were changes with the rest of the Liverpool game in mind as much as the Villa game on Saturday.
Yeah, and it's such a massive game now, the Villa game, because, you know, lose two games on the bounce going into the Interlull, that would not be ideal. It's too long to kind of chew over that negativity when really things have been going pretty well. So it's one of those games where I look at it and I think, you know, I probably would take a draw against Villa, actually, you know, just to kind of change the narrative a little bit, and they're not an easy place to go, and a point wouldn't be the worst thing before we regroup.
I would take 3 points, if you don't mind. if I have the choice, I'll take 3 points. I know what you're saying, but I maybe another measure of how this team is progressing and developing is how they deal with a defeat, because we lost to Man City on New Year's Day and then had those run of games, like two of them were against Liverpool, of course, and there was the Nottingham Forest game, and there were other things in play then. There was AFCON, there were, like, we had about 16 red cards in January, we had some injuries and the whole lot, so there were reasons why those games didn't go quite as well, and I really do think that the five games in a row that we won are more aligned to that New Year's Day performance than the immediate games that came after them. But I do think we have to make sure we respond against Villa on Saturday, where the one game at a time mantra really comes into play. Like, do not get carried away when you win, but also it doesn't mean the ceiling's fallen in when you lose, you know?
I mean, I looked at the games after, you know, when we came back from Dubai. There was quite an obvious chunk of games where you kind of thought, okay, how many points do we need to get from this section? And it's like, you can afford to maybe lose one game And then they added in the kind of Liverpool game rearranged, didn't they? So that kind of became the game that you were going to lose. And then, I mean, we have done very, very well. And I think we have to realise that to get to the number of points that we need to get this season from the games that we've got left, there is a tiny little bit of wiggle room, basically, to lose. But you just can't allow that defeat to get in your head and to manifest and become bigger. You know, I think, we just need to get through the Villa game with our spirit intact and then go again.
Mikel Arteta was not particularly pleased with the scheduling of the Aston Villa game, and he spoke about it at his press conference last night. I'm going to play the clip here so you can have a listen to this, and this is what he had to say, going a little bit pep in some of his answers, but here it is.
Okay, you mentioned the mental side of it, but physically you've got a very tight turnaround before you go to Villa Park. Considering the energy you're...
Thank you so much to the Premier League to do that, and they've done it again when we have to play Chelsea and Manchester United. So if they want to give them any advantage, I say to them today, thank you so much for doing that.
Do you think the players will be...
Yes, 100%. Don't worry, the players on Saturday, they will be there with energy. They will sleep, eat well. But thank you so much to the Premier League for putting the fixtures like this. Very, very helpful.
Did you make a representation to the Premier League?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because it's not fair. Yeah. It's not fair what they've done.
They just weren't for changing.
It's BT, it's Sky, it's this, it's that. Yeah, but the one that is affected is Arsenal. And the only thing that I care and we care is Arsenal. And for Arsenal, it's not fair.
I thought that was interesting, I have to say. Because, look, I understand completely. When you're playing at 8:15 on a Wednesday and then you get the early kickoff on a Saturday, and they did the same thing, we're going to have to face this in a couple of weeks' time, where we've got a Wednesday night game against Chelsea and then an early kickoff on Saturday against Manchester United, which I do have to say feels a little bit unfair, but that is the way that TV companies work. And remember, they're going to fuck us over with the Tottenham game as well. But in the pre-game stuff against Liverpool, I think he made a point. It wasn't about TV scheduling or whatever, but he said something along the lines of, like, I don't know, I hate all this, we feel sorry for ourselves, all that kind of stuff, you know. And this isn't necessarily feeling sorry for ourselves, but I wonder, is his public reaction to this, something we've talked about this season, is the us against them mentality that has been fostered at times. And I wonder if this is part of that as well. He feels aggrieved. There's no two ways about it. He feels unhappy about that. But he could easily say, well, look, there's nothing we can do about it. We've just got to get on and win the fixture, win the game, deal with the schedule the way it is. But he made a point of I think, to say it's not fair is quite strong. And I think that might be as much a message to his players and the fans, and trying to cultivate this siege mentality thing we've spoken about. I think it might be partly that.
Yeah, I mean, my first take on it is, it's not the type of thing he gives a shit about in a press conference or remarks about that strongly if Arsenal win the game. I think it's partly driven by the frustration of what's just played out in the 2 hours beforehand. Secondly, I mean, as much as I want him to foster that spirit, looking at it, I'm not sure that Arsenal are particularly screwed over by the situation. Obviously, it's not ideal playing late on a Wednesday, early on a Saturday. But when you actually look at the way the fixtures fall, Chelsea have got less, 24 hours less to prepare for the game against us, because they travel to Leeds on the Sunday and we face the Southampton on the Saturday.
And they've got to go by horse and cart as well. It's taking them a while to get up there.
And I guess that's balanced out by the fact that Manchester United have an extra 24 hours to prepare for the game against us because they play Liverpool on the Tuesday when we play on the Wednesday, but then they're playing Liverpool. So it's a big game. I don't know. I mean, at this time of the season, like, when games come thick and fast, and it's not like we're overburdened by matches at the moment, it kind of seems like a weird fight to pick. I'm more pissed off on behalf of the supporters who have to wait so long for these games to be kind of confirmed by the Premier League, who missed their deadline by about 3 weeks. Look, this is the first time this season, I guess, we're facing two sets of fixtures where we're really going to test our fitness and our legs. And, yeah, you know, if you're winning games, it's fine. You just carry that momentum. It's more if you have a hiccup and then you have to go again quickly. And even in those circumstances, you want another game quickly because,
you don't want it to fester. Yeah,
exactly. So it's a weird battle to pick, mostly because it's not one he can win. He's got no skin in the game there. Like, he's not going to influence the way the TV broadcasters make their selections or anything like that. I certainly don't think they're going to think twice about sticking, you know, Arsenal v Spurs on a Wednesday night, you know, just before the end of the season, which I think all of us are expecting.
Yeah,
it's an interesting one. I mean, I'm more than happy for him to kind of go, you know, backs against the wall. I'm really curious about how he's going to make them sleep well, what they're going to eat, because he mentioned that several times in several different interviews last night.
What is it? I was sitting there last night and I'd had a couple of beers watching the game and I was feeling a bit peckish, and he said, "We're going to have a good night's sleep. We're going to eat something nice." And I was like, "Ooh, what? what are you going to eat? Can I have the recipe,
crudités or something?" Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I get it. I guess quite a lot of these players, they kind of drink these kind of caffeine drinks, don't they, before games? And if you're doing that before a late kickoff, and then you've got the adrenaline of the game, I mean, fucking hell, I imagine it must be very, very difficult for Gabriel Martinelli, who gets home at midnight, to just go to sleep and then get up the next morning, go to training at, you know, whatever it is, 8, 9 o'clock, and you know, you're probably just sort of full of this sort of caffeine in you. And but, you know, I'm not being paid to work on the nutrition side of Arsenal's game. So it's someone else's problem. But
All right. Just one final thing. You were there, obviously. And at the final whistle, I know people have gone home because that's the nature of evening games. Even if it's a 7:45 kickoff, there are people who, for various reasons, leave before the end to get public transport, to avoid car park queues, whatever the hell it might be. You know, some people have got a significant distance to get home from the Emirates, ticket holders and all that kind of stuff. So we understand why that happens, but at the final whistle, there was a fairly rousing reception for the team, which hasn't always been the case when we've lost, when a game hasn't gone our way, when the result hasn't gone our way. You know, from your first-hand perspective, what did that feel like? And what does that tell you about the way the team and the fans are connected this season?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something going on. I mean, several people have remarked on it on Arsblog via columns, you know, written about it and stuff. There's a younger demographic who feels more in tune with what a match day experience should be, and that is around supporting the team. And it's not about carrying any other agendas into the stadium with the players. They like the players. They want the players to do well. It wasn't just at the full-time whistle that there was that kind of rousing reception, but it was
after the second goal.
Second goal, the crowd was probably at its noisiest in terms of trying to get the players going again. And I think that can only be a good thing for us going forward if we can maintain that. I mean, obviously, what we're feeding off as a crowd is the fact that we can see the players are giving their all and they're getting, you know, some good results this season. They've got to keep doing it because it's a kind of mutual relationship. If we start to fall off a cliff, it won't take too long for the grumbles to come back. But no, there's a nice, young, vibrant energy. There's also a sort of, there's a sort of aggression in the crowd actually at the moment. And I think that comes with the youthfulness. There's a sort of a sense that we need to turn this into an intimidating atmosphere, which for years has not been the case. You know, it's been, you know, like going to the opera or something, but it's been a kind of experience, a day out for some people. And now it's becoming like this place where we realize that we can play a part and we can really go at it. And it's something that is definitely, I mean, the stadium's just full. Absolutely full. Like, I mean, against Leicester, I thought it was really interesting because the game kicked off at 4:30, and again last night it kicked off at 8:15. I don't know whether people expected games to kick off at 4 and 8, but the stadium was much more full as the game kicked off, and it makes a difference because it means that there's just more people trying to put pressure on the opposition from the get-go, whereas quite often people get to the stadium a bit late and stuff. So, I mean, Arsenal have a big issue of making sure that people are in their seats before games. Part of that, they're trying to resolve, you know, the new ticketing kind of things on the on the gates and stuff. Just making sure that there's people in their seats. You know, they've had the beer promotions and stuff as well to get people in earlier in the season. All of that is a good thing because it does make a difference. It all adds up. And if people are enjoying the experience more and they like the fact that the singing's happening, they'll sing more the next time as well. So, yeah it's all good. I'm really happy with that stuff. I think the club will be pleased as well.
Yeah, all right. Results next, obviously. But, you know, we can take positives from that and hopefully respond when we go to Villa Park on Saturday. So.
I just had one last question because it wasn't immediately obvious what was going on, and I don't know whether it was at home, but the pitch invader. Did you see that? I mean, the guy seemed to come on at the North Bank end and he immediately ran to the goalpost and looked as if he was about to try and handcuff himself to the post.
Yeah.
And at that point I thought, oh my God, like this is going to be really awkward because if he does actually do that, you know, how long is that going to take to get him off? And then he just seemed to kind of act dead, like the steward pulled him off. It took ages for there to be a paramedic, like, to come and see him because nobody really knew whether he was actually, like, you know, incapacitated or if he was just acting. It was really weird.
As always on TV, they don't tend to show those incidents. I think if he had handcuffed himself to the goalpost, they probably would have had to show it. But the same with streakers. They never show them because they don't want to encourage it. So I don't really know. I haven't had a chance to read around as to what exactly the cause was or whatever it was that he was protesting. But we didn't see it. They mentioned it. They said, oh, there's a pitch invader here or there's somebody trying to attach himself to the goalpost. But they were showing there might have been a throw-in over on the right-hand side. So I don't really have any clue.
It was a very weird moment because I think particularly in the North Bank, it completely distracted the crowd. And I think it was in the period in between the two goals and the atmosphere definitely dropped a bit because everybody was trying to see what was going to happen to him because he'd been shoveled over the hoardings, was lying on the floor with a steward standing on his back, basically. A few of the photographers down there were taking pictures, but the way he was acting, it looked like he was dead. And, you know, as a consequence, the crowd were kind of like, oh, you know, what's going on? You know, completely distracted. And then, I mean, I don't think that had any effect on what was going on the pitch, but it was just a moment, a weird one.
Yeah, I just, I just had a quick look on Twitter, but the first link I see is a Daily Mail link. So I'm not going to click that. We'll find out, I guess. We'll find out. Strange incident. All right. Well, look, let's hope we can pick ourselves up and do the business against Villa on Saturday. For now, though, we'll leave it there. Andrew, as always, thank you very much.
See you later.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Thank you very much to Andrew. You can find him on Twitter at @AAllensport, at @AAllensport. Right. I am going to leave it there for this particular episode. As always, thank you very much indeed for being here. Hope you enjoyed the show. Join us on Patreon for a Premier League preview podcast tomorrow afternoon. And of course, James and I will be here on Monday with an Arsecast Extra talking about whatever goes down against Aston Villa on Saturday morning. As I said to Andrew, I'll take the 3 points if nobody minds. Until the next one, take it easy, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye. A day in the life with the man who decides the Premier League fixture schedule. I get up quite early, as a rule, and before my morning ablutions, I will have a bowl of oats. The fibres, tremendous for the digestion, you know? Helps loosen things up in there. Ha-ha! Then I take the dog for a walk. Well, I would if I had a dog, but I don't. I despise them. They're terrible, filthy creatures. And I sit down at my desk and I think to myself, how can I use my fixture, Mickey, to fuck Arsenal this week? I have to say, I always find a way. It's one of the things I enjoy most about this work. The variety, you see. Whatever challenges and problems there are to overcome, I can always manage to give them a good shafting. Then I basically spend the rest of my day on Twitter using my burner account at plsked826432829642161628. And I spend most of the rest of the day just trolling my balls off until the oats start to work again. God, I love oats.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.